fill myself with Arctic blueberries, crowberries, bearberries, and lingonberries, the last of which were still a bit tart, but perfectly acceptable to me. There was also dwarf Labrador tea for a warming drink, caribou lichens, a decent emergency food if you boil it first, and sphagnum moss, which is useful for treating cuts as it has naturally occurring iodine in it. With the berries finally ripening, it felt like having a supermarket right next to my camp. The character of my journey had now shifted again. I'd left the furious Coppermine River proper behind and was entering into a long series of interconnected lakes. Technically, I was still within the Coppermine River system, but now it was made up of almost all lakes connected by just a few narrow channels. Some of these channels did have powerful rapids, which I'd still have no choice but to battle up. But other than that, I was now turning the corner on my route's exhausting upriver travel. Most of these lakes lie beyond the trees, surrounded by nothing but apparently limitless tundra that in summer resembles vast fields, some of them boulder-strewn. To many people, it's a desolate, eerie-looking landscape, at least compared to the more hospitable forests to the south. On maps, these wild lakes appear as a virtually indecipherable maze of Byzantine complexity, featuring hundreds of bays, channels, islands, and peninsulas that can easily confuse travelers and make getting lost extremely easy. It was on these large lakes that I was now paddling that almost two centuries earlier, John Franklin led 20 men to horror and death on his first doomed quest for the Northwest Passage. Unlike his later, more famous naval expeditions in the high Arctic, on his first Arctic foray in 1821, Franklin had opted to travel by birch bark canoe with four British naval compatriots, a party of Canadian voyageurs, and two Inuit interpreters. Their expedition didn't turn out all that well. Although they managed to make it down the Coppermine River to the Arctic Ocean, and even traveled along its dangerous coast in canoes, on their return trek, things unraveled. Their food supplies ran out. The canoes were destroyed. One of their interpreters became lost. And finally, ragged and starving, they grew increasingly paranoid about one another. It seems some of them began to look at the others as meat. As they huddled around their tiny willow twig fires, whispers of cannibalism could be heard. One by one, the party dwindled, men falling behind and perishing alone on the tundra. The survivors eventually reached the very lakes I was paddling, but without canoes, they were unable to cross them, at least until winter froze them solid. For days they wandered, desperate and destitute, along the barren shorelines. Of the 21 men who set off, only 10 returned. It was also this same landscape that a half century before Franklin, back in 1770, the young sailor Samuel Hearne and his friend Matonabbee had made an epic journey on foot across thousands of kilometers. They'd set out from Churchill and wandered all the way to the mouth of the Coppermine River and back again. Matonabbee and Hearne, upon first sight of the river, with the sort of wisdom one gets from living in these places, immediately judged it far too treacherous to be navigable. Their journey, however, was marred by the tragedy of Bloody Falls, when Matonabbee's Dene followers ambushed and massacred an unsuspecting Inuit camp. The attack was part of a larger, centuries-old conflict between the Inuit, who lived near the seacoast, and the Dene, who lived to the south within the spruce forests. Between them lay the vast no-man's land of the Barrens, where battles tended to happen if wandering hunting parties ever crossed paths. A long day of steady paddling took me through rock nest lakes, snaking bays, and channels. By midday, I'd reached a narrow section with rapids where I had to put away my paddle and pull hard off the bottom. This brought me into a new body of water, Red Rock Lake, which I found surrounded by rocky hills and, most prominently, a gigantic towering cliff over 100 meters high, composed of red rock. I figured that this was probably the origin of the lake's name. I'd been paddling steady, dealing with wind that was alternatingly hitting my canoe broadside, head-on, or from behind, the direction changing based on the zigzagging pattern of the lake's maze-like shape. A light rain dissipated as I completed a necessary crossing from the lake's northern to southern shore over a large stretch of open water with big waves. Then I spotted something farther up the opposite shore, a collection of little white and brown rectangular specks that clearly indicated something human-made. It was, I guessed, most likely some fly-in fishing lodge, although I'd never heard of one existing on this lake, which seemed odd. A small open motorboat materialized near the white and brown specks, a lone figure on board. The boat moved back and forth along the distant shoreline. Evidently, the person on board was trolling, likely for lake trout. My little speck of red moving alone up the far shore eventually attracted the notice of the figure in the motorboat that had issued out from the mysterious encampment, and the boat now powered across the lake in my direction. When the boat neared, I saw on board a young man, seemingly not much older than 20. He switched off his engine and coasted in toward me. "Hello," he called, waving. "Hi," I said. "Where did you come from?" he asked. "The Yukon." "What?" He looked puzzled. "I'm paddling across the Arctic."
"All by yourself?"
"Yeah."
"My God!"
He stared at me. "That's a nice-looking fishing lodge," I said, pointing across the lake. I could see it a bit better now, and compared to any other fly-in fishing camp I'd ever seen, this one looked rather more elaborately constructed. I didn't know there was one on this lake.
"Oh, that's not a lodge," he said.
Catching my intrigued look, he launched into an explanation. He said the compound belonged to a mega-wealthy airline tycoon who'd had it built as an ultra-private fishing escape for his family and friends, with a whole lake to themselves, miles from anywhere. The owner, who was 95 years old, was at the compound this very moment, having recently arrived on one of his float planes. "He'd love to meet you and have you stay," said the young man enthusiastically. "Do you want a hot shower? You can stay the night. We can feed you, too. We've got plenty of spare beds. It'll be great." I hovered on the waves. "Do you have any orange juice?"
"We've got loads of orange juice," he exclaimed.
"Well," I said, mulling it over, "I'm afraid I have to be on my way. I'm on a tight schedule. Maybe next time I'm here. Thanks, though." The young man looked a little downcast, but seeing my resolve to keep paddling, he wished me well with real warmth. The truth was, I'd become so accustomed to my routine of long days that I didn't wish to deviate from it. More importantly, the winds were at the moment pretty good, so I couldn't afford not to make the most of them, fearing as I did what the storms of August would bring. I paddled hard, wanting to put as much distance as I could between me and the compound of more than a half dozen small buildings. To me, it had been a bizarre sight, jarringly incongruous after passing thousands of kilometers of natural landscapes. To suddenly see buildings perched on rocks in the middle of nowhere felt like stumbling upon the set of a science fiction movie. I thought how it must have cost a fortune to have built such a place. All the construction materials, furniture, solar panels, motorboats, and other stuff would have had to have been flown in by helicopter or bush plane from far away. But I guess it's the kind of thing that's easier if you own an airline. I pushed on another 4 hours, paddling up the lake's snaking bays past islands and barren hills. Appealing campsites were scarce, as the lake's shoreline was high banks cloaked with willow thickets. Hauling all my gear up such steep banks wasn't a pleasing prospect, especially since sleeping inland like that would mean enduring appalling clouds of bugs. Whenever possible on lakes, I try to camp near an open shoreline, where a breeze can help keep the bugs to an acceptable minimum. But after passing kilometers of shoreline with just high, willow-thicketed banks, I realized I had no choice. I pulled into a steep, 15-foot-high bank and wearily began hauling my three loads, and then the canoe, up to the top to make camp. The bugs were as bad as I feared. Masses of them assaulted me, making eating my freeze-dried mac and cheese joyless. Just pulling up my mesh bug net a little to take a bite caused suffocating clouds to swarm my face. How many I swallowed with the food I'll never know.
I just tried to eat as fast as possible so I could escape into my tent. Glancing at a satellite image of northern Canada, you'll see that there are 3 million lakes, creeks, ponds, and rivers. In your spare time, I suggest counting them, most of which are of recent vintage, having been gouged out during the retreat of the massive, mile-high Laurentide ice sheet 10,000 years ago or less, depending on their location. With that many different waterways, the amount of resulting route combinations are infinite. You could live 1,000 lifetimes and not even begin to scratch the surface of paddling all the possibilities. To devise my particular route, I examined satellite imagery, looking at what at first glance appeared an incomprehensible labyrinth. Then I measured distances between points to create the most efficient route I could, while taking into account whatever else seemed important. In those first few weeks of planning, though, every time I looked at the satellite images or topographic maps laid out on my desk and posted on my walls, it was difficult to make heads or tails of them all. With such a puzzle of lakes and ponds, it's hard not to confuse one bay or inlet for any of the thousands of others. But once I'd committed it to memory, I could pick out at a glance on any large topographic map or satellite image my exact route, and what day I ought to be on any nameless bay or point. As a kid, I always enjoyed puzzles and memory games, but it didn't seem like it would ever amount to much career-wise. Then, I realized I could put it to good use doing these sorts of journeys. A GPS built into your brain is a huge asset, one that's easy to overlook how advantageous it is when traveling, as checking a map or GPS screen is time-consuming. It's not like checking a phone at home with the swipe of a finger. In the wilderness, the GPS has first to power up, load the satellite imagery, and then, on a small screen, fiddle with it for a bit to see what you need. These memory and spatial skills, the ability to transfer a two-dimensional map image into a real three-dimensional lake, were exactly what I needed now to navigate these lakes quickly, without fiddling every 10 minutes with maps or a GPS. My route from the end of the Coppermine River proper would next take me through a complex maze of different lakes across the Central Arctic, more than 36 in all. The distance I'd have to cover through these often dangerously windy lakes, plus a bit of river travel and portaging for good measure, totaled roughly 883 kilometers, or more than double the distance I'd crossed on Great Bear Lake. Of course, the actual distance, when factoring in the multiple trips required to complete the many portages between lakes and around dangerous rapids, was considerably greater. On the last day of July, I paddled into a new lake, Point Lake, which is over 100 kilometers long and punctuated by numerous bays, islands, and peninsulas. The lake seemed almost unnaturally quiet. There was barely a hint of wind. The skies had turned blue without a speck of cloud. There weren't even sounds of birds or any sign of wildlife. I'd paddled far offshore, so even the bugs had vanished. There was nothing to be seen in all directions except rocks, cliffs, hills, and tundra. It was a strange, empty, quiet place, so calm that it felt as if I were paddling in a landscape painting. The dead calm allowed me to make excellent progress, in part because I was able to cut across the largest open water crossings I'd ever attempted solo in the Arctic, in some places exceeding 3 kilometers between points. To be that far from land, surrounded by nothing but blue water on all sides, alone in my heavily packed canoe, could make me slightly uneasy, but I felt the calm conditions more than justified it. The result was excellent progress, allowing me to make it over 65 kilometers that day. To add to such agreeable weather, when I made camp I found my first ripe lingonberries of the season, though the bugs were extreme on shore. Interestingly, I calculated after repeated experiments that it took an average of 5 minutes after landing for the full onslaught of millions of bugs to materialize. This meant that I had a few minutes of relative peace to gather berries before the bugs passed along the word that human flesh was to be had for the taking. The only wood available now were little bits of dwarf birch, typically no larger than finger-sized, and these I burned just for the smoke to help drive off the insect swarms. For boiling water, I now relied on my little camp stove. The eerie, perfect calm lasted for several days as July passed into August. I continued paddling 11 or 12 hours each day, tripling the daily distances I'd manage when traveling upstream on rivers. My route took me past great towering cliffs, jumbles of immense boulders as old as time, and vast grassy fields without a tree in sight. In other places, some of the great gray cliffs were so cracked with fault lines as to give the suggestion of ancient masonry, as if they were crumbling castle ruins. On one of these vertical cliffs overlooking the lake, raspy little cries rang out as I paddled below. Looking up, I spotted in a crack on the cliff face two baby peregrine falcons. They were hungry, calling for their parents to serve lunch. I was hungry too, and that night when I landed on a rocky, hilly shore to make camp, I could barely contain my excitement at what I found. The first ripe batch of cloudberries. These are my favorite of all berries. They're big, juicy orange berries, a bit sour but wonderfully delicious. Perhaps especially if you've taken the trouble to spend several months eating only energy bars. I ate multitudes of the cloudberries, finding a veritable jackpot of them on a hillside. Cloudberries occur all across northern Canada, but in Newfoundland they're known as bake apples, on account of tasting something like a baked apple, and also because Newfoundlanders like making up their own names for things. The thought of baked apples while I sat alone on the hillside eating cloudberries reminded me of a childhood memory. My father had spent the better part of 2 years building our house with his own hands. My brother and I at the time were only 7, and while he worked long hours on the house, we were turned loose in the encircling woods to amuse ourselves. One late summer day, having made a fire with a magnifying glass, we were naturally keen to roast marshmallows over it. My father, however, who was busy working on the house alone, said we had none. To get us out of his hair, he told us that when he was a boy, he used to roast apples, telling us these made a wonderful treat, and he fetched us some from an old overgrown tree on the edge of the woods. I was so excited at the thought of this delicious treat that I picked the best apple I could find among the bunch he brought. With the cut green stick for a spit, I patiently roasted mine with care, my mouth watering. When the apple was good and roasted, I bit into it with excitement, only to scowl. It didn't taste good at all, just sour. As I busied myself setting up my tent on a level patch of moss and lichens, still snacking on the abundant cloudberries, I thought to myself that the taste of baked apples was the finest thing in the world. I awoke the next morning to a strange haze hanging over the land. At first I thought it might be fog, but as I packed up my gear, I realized it was something else. The haze had a faint smell of smoke about it, which told me that somewhere far off to the south, in the land of the trees, there must be forest fires. The winds had carried the haze north across the tundra, perhaps from hundreds of miles away. This thick haze, combined with the absence of wind, gave the glassy lakes and silent, rock-strewn hills an odd feel, almost as if I drifted into some timeless world. The calm weather and eerie haze lasted for days. These windless days were also unnaturally hot, which made the clouds of black flies extreme whenever I landed on shore. My wrists were badly swollen from numerous itchy bites. Even my eyelids had red sores on them. Lying inside my tent beneath the surreal haze and midnight sun, strange cries would pierce the silence. Young gulls along the lake, which make the oddest cries. When the haze dissipated on the wind, it would reveal what looked increasingly to my mind like a fairy tale landscape, vivid green hills with ancient gray rocks and boulders beyond counting scattered about, with the odd little stream crashing a path down the rocky hillsides. I could picture dinosaurs walking about amid the lichen-covered rocks that were eons older than even those giant reptiles. More and more, it seemed like a land time forgot. The unnaturally calm weather I knew was but a brief interlude from the terrifying high winds of the Arctic tundra. I knew full well the power of those winds sweeping off Hudson Bay in late summer, that they'd been clocked at nearly 200 kilometers an hour, that they'd trapped canoeing parties for 10 days or more on the barrens with relentless gusts that made paddling impossible. I'd heard stories of bush pilots and search and rescue aircraft whose planes were grounded for weeks by the power of the gales. Nothing filled me with greater dread than the thought of those great gusting winds as I paddled across icy lakes. But while the dead calm reigned, I intended to make the most of it. I pushed myself 12 hours a day to try to get as far across the tundra as I could before the weather turned bad, as inevitably it would. On August 3rd, I passed through a narrow, rapid-filled channel connecting Point Lake to Lake Providence, wading the rapids and leaping from boulder to boulder. The next day, I was at it again, paddling through the haze across more lakes and confronting more rapids in the narrow connecting channels. The first of these rapids was large and came in two sets. I managed to wade up both of them cautiously, sparing me a lengthy portage over rock-strewn terrain. A third rapid followed soon after. This, too, I waded through along the edge. But a fourth stretch of long, powerful rapids defeated my efforts to wade it. I concluded I'd have to make a painstaking portage of about a half kilometer over rough terrain of willow thickets, boulders, steep hills, and finally soggy marshes to get around it. This portage was extremely exhausting, given the intensity of the blackfly attacks combined with the unusually warm weather, about 19 degrees Celsius. So, when it came time for my fourth load, the canoe, I had a mind to try getting it up the rapids with a combination of wading and lining, which I figured I could do now that it was empty. Anything, it seemed, was worth it to avoid the nightmarish string of obstacles in the long, pathless portage. In this roaring, dangerous rapid, I banged my shin hard against a rock ledge concealed beneath the swirling, foaming water. Wedged in a crevice formed by the ledge, I struggled to free my leg and get out of the rushing torrent back to safer ground, ignoring the pain. Pulling back and forth on my boot, holding onto the canoe, and struggling to maintain my balance on the rapids, I finally got free and made it to the safety of the bank. "Well," I said to the canoe, "that one's really going to leave a mark." Exhausted, I reached the end of the rapids, repacked the canoe, and paddled across the nameless lake I'd arrived on, passing by a grizzly on shore that ran off at the sight of me. Then I made camp near a willow thicket, my body aching from the labors of the day, my shin swollen, and myself utterly exhausted. Chapter 15, On Rocky Shores. The week of hot, hazy, windless weather ended abruptly on August 5th. Frigid air came over the land, bringing with it rain and strong winds. The sudden cold weather seemed to miraculously dissolve the clouds of bugs, leaving the air clear and letting me breathe freely without a bug net. I could hardly believe it. On the downside, the stiff winds could make travel hazardous. Fortunately, I was setting out on a series of smaller lakes, so for now anyway, I'd be more or less protected from any big waves. My plan was to paddle through the chain of lakes. Some were small enough that I could cross them in mere minutes, and then portage to the next one, totaling several dozen in all. This would eventually take me out of the Arctic Ocean's watershed and into the Hudson Bay drainage basin, after which all the rivers would be flowing eastward, the direction I was headed, allowing me to travel much faster, exactly what I needed if I were to complete my journey before the weather rendered canoe travel impossible. To get to the Hudson Bay watershed, however, was easier said than done. I had a long way to go, with no trails to follow and topographic maps that left something to be desired. The map showed many of these lakes as connected by streams, whereas in reality there was nothing but impassable boulder fields linking them. On August 5th, I managed to complete four separate portages, passing through a total of six different lakes, each similar to the one before, surrounded as they were by rocky, hilly tundra. The strong winds were mostly blowing southwest, which actually helped propel me rapidly across the lakes. My feet, though, were drenched from portaging over sodden moss and rain-soaked dwarf birch, as I'd switched back to my hiking boots now that I was done with wading. I wanted the extra ankle support for the rugged portages. The uneven ground made portaging vastly more difficult than would be the case on a hard-packed surface with a trail to follow. But I was simply grateful that the cold and windy weather had driven off the bugs, and for the bounty of delicious wild berries that allowed me to snack anywhere I liked now. Through the steady rain, I transported each of my four loads across dense willow thickets, a favorite haunt of grizzlies, and around rocks to the next body of water. Some portages required different methods. One marshy section I wore my waders through. Others, I changed into my hiking boots to better jump from rock to rock across dried-up creek beds filled with big gray boulders. Another day brought me across another 8 lakes and another 8 portages separating them. My barrels were getting a little emptier, such that I actually began to carry the lighter of the two simultaneously with my backpack. This cut the number of loads from 4 to 3, and trips back and forth over the rocky hills and marshy valleys from 7 to 5. In other words, a 1 kilometer portage was now no longer a 7 kilometer ordeal, merely a 5 kilometer one. Crossing one little nameless lake, I saw 2 heads moving across the choppy waters. I assumed they were caribou, which regularly swim across lakes and rivers. But as I paddled closer, I realized it was actually a cow moose with a young calf. I wondered what they were doing north of the tree line. Moose don't normally roam about on the Arctic tundra like caribou do. Then it occurred to me that these moose were likely driven north by the forest fires that had been raging somewhere to the south. Hopefully, the rainy weather would allow them to return home soon. By early afternoon, I had reached Starfish Lake, the first lake large enough to have a name on my maps for some days. It was not quite 10 kilometers long, and I battled stiff winds all the way up it. From Starfish Lake, I hoped to advance into a much larger body of water over 60 kilometers long, known as Courageous Lake. Connecting these two lakes was a hypothetical stream drawn on my topographical map. I wasn't so naive as to believe such a stream actually existed in anything like a navigable state. But on some level, everyone has hopes and dreams, and mine were now principally that such streams might really exist, like unicorns or leprechauns. Otherwise, I'd be in for yet another long and arduous portage. The winds were fierce as I approached Starfish Lake's southern shores to search for any hint of a stream. The choppy waters complicated my paddling efforts, since to pivot and paddle along the shore meant allowing waves to hit the canoe broadside. A spill into icy water here would test my fire-making skills to the utmost. Cautiously, I angled my canoe diagonally as I weaved in toward the rocky coastline. The stream, I could see, was just a dried-up, boulder-filled creek bed. I'd have to portage. But where and how to land the canoe? Waves were pounding into the rocky shoreline, with no sand beaches or soft soil visible anywhere for me to glide into. The last thing I wanted was to drive the canoe into the masses of jagged rocks along the lakeshore, smashing the canoe and tossing me into frigid waters. I looked in vain for anywhere to safely land. There was nothing. So that settled it. I had to take my chances. To execute a landing in waves onto a shoreline composed of great jumbles of jagged rock would take perfect timing and maneuvering. I wasn't sure I could pull it off, but sometimes you just have to go for it. I edged closer to the rocks, letting the waves carry me in. It was critical that I time my landing between waves. When I was as close as I could safely get, I let a final wave pass by and then made my move, drawing a stroke of my paddle to first drive the canoe forward and then 2 more to sharply spin it parallel to the rocks. I had only seconds to jump out before the next wave rolled in and slammed the canoe against the rocks. I made my dash, getting both feet onto the rocks, which were slick from the rain and waves. Then, I grabbed the heavily loaded canoe to hold it steady, but a wave jostled it into the rocks. Fortunately, it was the side that took the impact, and its tough design was in little danger of any damage there. It was the underside that worried me, where the ice and rocks had been by degrees grinding it thinner. Moving as fast as I could, I pulled out my barrels and backpack, then lifted the canoe up onto the rocks. Finally, after I'd secured everything, I turned around to consider where I'd landed. Tall shrubs of leafy green willows screened my view of what lay inland, so I took the pole as a staff and set off to scout which way to head for my portage. So far, the portages hadn't been too bad. I felt optimistic. Pushing through the willows, my heart sank. What I saw looked like a nightmare. A vast boulder field, its enormous slabs heaped and tumbled every which way like rubble after an earthquake, stretched as far as I could see in the direction I had to head. To hike across it without a heavy pack would be hard enough. To do it with four loads and high winds seemed rather hazardous. It was the perfect place to twist an ankle, or fall and smash my face off a boulder. Outside the chaotic boulder field, things were scarcely any better. The uneven ground was cloaked in almost impenetrable dwarf birch thickets at least chest high. Neither option was a good one, but I opted for the birches. It was already early evening, and I didn't have time to delay. With my backpack strapped on, I slung my lighter barrel over one shoulder and set off into the thicket. It was my fourth portage of the day, so I was at least suitably warmed up for it. The cold wind also ensured that there were no bugs to torment me. It took a few dozen steps before I gave up on the idea of making it through the thicket. The bushes were too easy to trip over, and concealed beneath them were more boulders. Back I went into the piles of rubble, ancient Precambrian rocks, billions of years old, covered in lichens. By comparison, they seemed easier, as long as I made sure of my footing. I stepped across yawning cracks between the great slabs, jumping from one oddly rectangular-shaped boulder to another, climbing up and down, enjoying the full cardio workout. I had about a kilometer of this to do before I'd reach the next lake, or rather, more than that, since the obstacle course meant I couldn't travel in a straight line. After a while, I tired of climbing boulders. Plus, the birch shrubs seemed to have thinned somewhat, so I veered back into them. They didn't prove much thinner, but I decided to try my luck in them anyway. I plowed through the tall bushes, pushing them aside with one hand as I trudged along ground that sloped up, then down, with deep pockets strewn all about. The thickets made navigation trickier, since I couldn't see much in them, but I knew which direction to head and kept a steady course. When I grew tired of struggling through tangled birches, I crossed back into the great boulders, and then back again to the birches, as my fancy dictated. Sometimes, I find, simple variety is encouraging when portaging. Eventually, lying beyond haphazard piles of rocks and boulders everywhere, I caught sight of blue water ahead. I pushed on over the last stretch and was delighted to discover, amid a wilderness of desolate rock, a patch of moss, crowberries, and dwarf Labrador tea just big enough for my tent. It'd make a nice soft bed for the night. I set down my two loads beside it and turned around to fetch my next one, the heavy barrel. Zigzagging around the various obstacles, coupled with the thickets and the uneven ground, made hiking back and forth time-consuming and physically draining. By the time I headed back for my final load, the canoe, it was getting late, but I hoped with hard effort to get it across, so as to be fresh and ready for an early start come morning. Given the obstacles, I'd have to carry the canoe over my head. But that would restrict my vision, which is not a thing to be lightly dismissed when there are no trails to follow. I needed to be able to look up to pick out a path of least resistance among the rubbles and shrubs. Further complicating things were the gusting winds. Still, I began gamely, lifting the canoe up to my knee and then tossing it over my head. I made it five steps before a wind gust caught the canoe and threw me into a boulder. Clearly, jumping from rock to rock with a canoe over my head in high winds would be more difficult than it seemed. I unclipped the water bottle from my belt, took some sips, and rested for a bit. Then I ate a granola bar that I'd stuffed into my pocket. Feeling fortified, I lifted the canoe again, gripped it tightly, and moved forward as best as I could. I headed for the colossal rubble fields. I figured I'd rather climb among the rocks, where I could at least see my feet, than plow into birch shrubs that concealed everything below the waist and made tripping easy. After a few hundred meters of weaving amid the boulders, my energy and strength were too drained for it. Sooner or later, another gust would knock me over, and I might topple 5 or 6 feet off a rock slab, smashing my head off a boulder. Thus, I decided to cut back into the pathless birches, in the hopes of simply dragging the canoe behind me among them. Dragging was painstakingly slow and exhausting. As the thicket was, it turned out, not easy to plow through with a canoe. Frequently I had to rest. It had been 11 hours so far of paddling and portaging, and as much as I disliked the thought, I realized my canoe and I were going to have to spend the night apart. I laid it beside a big willow bush and tucked it in as comfortably as I could, promising to return first thing in the morning. On the far side of the portage, I settled in for a night on my little patch of soft moss amid the ancient boulders. It was a fine campsite, surely one of life's greatest pleasures. Since the tundra is riddled with hummocks and holes, there have been many nights when I had to sleep on uneven ground. In other places, it was difficult just to climb back down to the shore to fetch water for boiling or driftwood for burning. Filling a pot with water, too, could be easier said than done when the water was difficult to access due to immense jumbles of rocks that extend far out from shore, with just little pockets of water, too small to scoop from, in between the rocks. In less desirable sites, too, I might sleep in willow thickets that made it easy to lose anything I had unpacked. But here, everything was perfect. The tundra was covered in short little plants and mosses, wonderful for spreading things out on and looking over my gear, and there were nice slabs of flat rocks for cooking on. My pole, meanwhile, I converted into a clothesline by jabbing it into some rock crevices, and I'd strung my wet clothing up on it. My rain jacket, the lighter of my two jackets I'd brought, was clearly becoming old and worn, as it was no longer keeping me very dry. Still, I was as content as could be, admiring the beauty and solitude of this rock-filled landscape. It was a little surreal how, 9 or 10,000 years ago, the glaciers had arranged the great boulders in their present position. Nearby, one giant rock had come to rest precariously on top of another, a bit like a giant booby trap. In the crevice of another rock, I found a spider's web. This interested me greatly, as spiders reach their northern distribution in the southern Arctic, where they can tolerate the extreme cold and feed on the abundant bugs during brief summers. I hadn't seen many of them on my journey. I find patterns in nature, like a spider's intricate web or the colossal heaps of rubble left by a melting glacier thousands of years ago, or the ancient cliffs weathered and shaped by the elements for eons into resembling masonry, can keep a person engrossed for hours. I retrieved my canoe early the next morning and completed the portage in good time. The rain had subsided, but it remained cold and windy. Reaching Courageous Lake, I'd crossed another watershed divide, though not the coveted Hudson Bay one that I was after. Hard paddling, battling side winds took me south through Courageous Lake, where I passed the giant sand peninsula before coming to the lake's big eastern bay. The scenery was gorgeous, with sandy beaches, dunes, and rolling grassy fields. Once I'd rounded the giant peninsula, the wind was in my favor and I could travel much faster, weaving between islands. Tucked in a sandy bay, I spotted some ruins. It was an abandoned fly-in fishing lodge consisting of little plywood cabins. There are a few of these scattered across the north. Back in the 1990s, sport fishing was a bigger draw, and it was possible for quite a few of these remote camps to operate. There are still some in business, but this one had clearly been left to rot away. All of these lakes, I knew well, were home to delicious lake trout and other cold water species that can survive in their icy, nutrient-poor depths. As I completed my crossing of the lake, I noticed a few other signs of humans. Appearing as tiny specks on the horizon, I made out some radio towers. These, I knew, were associated with mining operations in the area. Indeed, I saw in the far distance inland across the tundra some sort of mining encampment, a few little cabins or something. In a land of rocks, willows, tundra, and lakes that seemed to go on forever, the sight of these objects felt very bizarre, like looking at something that belonged in another world. Approximately 60 kilometers northeast of me were major open-pit mining operations for diamonds. Those massive mines functioned as off-the-grid operations, supplied by aircraft and resembling a sort of lunar colony. That night, I slept on a wonderful bit of mossy tundra, luxuriously comfortable despite the sandflies that showed up to disturb my peace. But inside my tent, I was happy. I could see a full moon rising over the pale sky. There were now a few hours of partial darkness each night. The season was getting on. As I drifted off to sleep, the words, "Winter is coming," were at the back of my mind. Chapter 16 of Wind and Waves. Mid-August was supposed to be the date after which the winds became increasingly unmanageable for canoeing on the Arctic tundra. It was now August 8th, so I figured I had only a week of decent weather left. I had to make the most of it, especially now that the biggest lakes I'd seen since Great Bear lay in front of me. It was thus discouraging to awake to high winds that morning, which promised to make paddling extremely difficult. Under ordinary circumstances, it was the kind of wind that would prompt a day off to rest, but that was no longer an option for me. Fierce as the wind was, I had to push on. After all, I told myself, if I can't handle this wind, what chance would I have in another couple of weeks when it got really bad? 11 hours of hard, exhausting paddling saw me advance only 30 kilometers. The wind had constantly been hitting the canoe broadside, so that the majority of my strokes were merely to keep the canoe from crashing into shore, rather than propelling it forward. I passed rapidly down a small river, known as the Snake River, the first river I'd paddled on with the current for almost 3 weeks, since the Kendall River. It was a short river with some small rapids and ledges that were easily navigated, the only difficulty arising from the powerful wind gusts that I had to counteract by paddling while simultaneously zigzagging around rocks. The Snake River spit me out into a large body of water known as McKay Lake. In rough weather, if I had to trace out its shoreline to where I needed to get to, that total is 66-kilometer paddle. But I hoped for a calm spell that would allow me to make a large open water crossing, island hopping across the center of the lake, and thereby greatly reducing the distance to its northeast tip where I needed to end up. I camped on the lake's western shore, my little tent and canoe looking very lonesome against a backdrop of miles of grassy tundra with hardly a feature on it other than some small hills. The tundra here was almost entirely devoid of rocks, resembling more of an overgrown soccer field. The wind stayed cold and strong. I had to use my canoe and two barrels as a windbreak just to boil water over the camp stove. As I waited for it to boil, I took the opportunity to eat as many cloudberries, crowberries, lingonberries, and blueberries as I could. While searching out these berries, I made an unexpected find, a clump of thick white fur lying on the tundra. At first it looked uncomfortably like polar bear fur, but I was still too far inland for polar bears, which stay near the seacoast hunting seals, so I told myself it couldn't be from a bear. It seemed more likely to be the fur of an Arctic wolf or even Arctic fox, though I favored a wolf as it felt too coarse for a fox, and anyway, a fox would still have its gray summer coat at this time of year. After dinner, I bundled up to stay warm and crawled into my tent. The full moon rose over the lake with a pale orange glow against a purple sky. The nights were growing almost dark now. My gear was starting to feel the effects of continuous use in the elements. The tent was patched in a few places with duct tape, and its main support pole had stripped where it attached at the joint, due to the pressure of the winds. My canoe was a more serious concern. The gouges were really accumulating and getting deeper from all the grinding over endless rocky rapids. Both my paddles were chipped up along the blades from jabbing at rocks, My legs were pretty bruised up too, from wading and bumping into rocks in the rapids. I fell asleep, wondering what the dawn would bring. If I were to cross the lake's big open water, I'd need fair weather. The morning of August 9th broke in my favor. The skies were clear and the lake calm, with just a pleasant breeze. I was determined to take full advantage of the conditions. In the high winds and dangerous waves, I'd never risk crossing the lake. But in this calm weather, it was no problem. I cut across a 2-kilometer open stretch to some grassy islands, followed along this archipelago for some way, then made another 2-kilometer crossing to a big point, and from there another open water crossing to the lake's end that I needed to reach. Among those islands, I saw mergansers swimming in the water, and on the rocky shore, a great bald eagle looking regal and majestic. There were also some rocks. Living outdoors, you quickly become attuned to the weather and the way indoor life makes impossible. Every change, no matter how slight, in the weather's mood demands attention, and you begin to realize just how variable weather can be. Every shift in the wind, which it did frequently, would directly affect my traveling, like which side of a lake to follow or which side of my canoe to paddle on. And these changing moods of the weather increasingly influence my own. High winds demoralized me. Cold weather made me forlorn, and clear skies and calm conditions left me carefree. I made camp early that evening, selecting a site near deep water along a small beach. This was to be the site of my third and final resupply. A resupply by necessity cost me to lose a precious day, as it would take that long to arrange things and wait for a pilot. It was a shame to lose the time, but to press on any farther would drive up the cost of the resupply flight, as the pilots charged by the kilometer for how far they flew, and with the increasing winds, the likelihood of delayed flights was increasing. Besides, my rations wouldn't last the more than 1,000 kilometers of travel that still lay ahead. How long that would take to traverse was difficult to forecast, considering how heavily it depended on weather. On a calm day, I might make 100 kilometers. On a windy day, zero. I knew of a pair of paddlers who, almost 20 years earlier, had completed the trip from here to Baker Lake in just 33 days. But there had been 2 of them paddling together, and only 1 of me, and they'd done it in midsummer during the best wind conditions, not late in the season. They'd also taken exceptional risks to make such time, cutting across big lakes far from shore and running dangerous whitewater rapids. Still, I had the advantage of youth over them. And whereas they'd started cold after a float plane dropped them off on the lake, my body was already conditioned from thousands of kilometers of journeying. If I could, on my own, equal the 2 of them together, even with the worst weather, that put me in Baker Lake to end my journey by September 15th, late in the year for Arctic canoeing. If I couldn't match their pace, or if the wind held me back further, I'd be looking at the onset of winter. These were the kinds of calculations I had to ponder as I sat on the tundra overlooking the water, trying to decide how much extra weight in the form of rations and propane fuel canisters to carry from here on out. It was a double-edged sword. More food would give me a larger cushion. More weight would slow my paddling and compound the many long, arduous portages around dangerous canyons I knew lay ahead of me. If my rations ran out, I couldn't get more resupplies. My budget for flights was used up, and the farther I went, the more expensive any hypothetical flight would become. In terms of paddling speed, I probably couldn't equal what the combined efforts of 2 paddlers could do together, but I could exceed them, I figured, in the length of the days I put in, more like the tortoise and hare than ever. Ultimately, I resolved on 5 weeks worth of supplies on the basis that I hoped to equal the 2 paddlers who had done it in midsummer. If I had to go a little hungry toward the end, I figured I could manage it. In the meantime, the weather just now was glorious, and since I was stuck waiting for the float plane, I figured I'd go for a swim while it was still possible. Catching my reflection in the water, I realized how thin I'd become. I guessed I'd shed about 20 pounds since I started the journey. After a brief dip in the frigid water, I let the sun dry me as I sat on the tundra, watching bold little Arctic ground squirrels scurrying about on the sand, chirping and standing up like prairie dogs to look around. That night I slept soundly on a nice bed of lichens. The next morning dawned with overcast skies. A thunderstorm rolled in over the lake, but rolled out just as quickly, narrowly missing me. A tent pitched on flat tundra isn't the most carefree place during lightning strikes, but I always selected my sites with care, away from high points or big rocks, in lower-lying areas wherever possible. The resupply flight was delayed. They always seemed to be. And it wasn't until late afternoon through a cloud patch that I saw the small plane materialize. The pilot circled round, spotted my tent and overturned canoe, then skidded down across the water. It wasn't possible for the plane to come in toward shore due to some rocks that extended far out. So I had to paddle out to the plane to get my supplies. This was a different pilot from the one who'd resupplied me back on the copper mine almost 3 weeks earlier. Things went quickly. He stood on the plane's aluminum float and handed me my barrel. I sorted through it, then gave it back to him empty. He wished me well, made an encouraging comment about the gale force winds coming in the weeks ahead, and how he sure was glad he wouldn't be out here during that time, then revved his engine back to life, wished me well again, and departed for the long flight back. His was the last face I'd see for a while. It was only 4 p.m., so I decided to press on. I'd already lost a full day's worth of travel waiting for the resupply since reaching the end of McKay Lake, and I couldn't afford to waste a minute more. The winds were light, so I set off. Draining McKay Lake is the Lockhart River, a short river but one with serious white water, the kind you wouldn't want to make the slightest mistake in. I was paddling with the current, and would be for the remainder of my journey. That meant much faster travel, but also the need for caution around dangerous rapids. The first rapid I came to was a big roaring affair, more than a half kilometer long, where the river descended steeply through a narrow stretch. It was the kind of thing I might possibly have run on a warm summer's day in a less remote locale with an empty canoe. Here, alone, on the Arctic tundra, any mistake could be fatal. The safe option would be to portage, but that would be time-consuming and exhausting. As an alternative, I could try to wade down the edge of it, hopping from rock to rock, and guide my canoe down with ropes, keeping it safely out of the big waves in the center. For months, I'd become accustomed to wading up rapids, so it felt a little strange to now be wading down them. This wasn't actually any easier, as going downstream the canoe is more difficult to control when lining or wading, and like with upstream travel, the force of the roaring current is always threatening to tear the canoe away. I had to combine caution and force to get it through safely. Sometimes this meant letting out the rope and allowing the canoe to drift ahead on the current and around the rocks, where I could then catch up to it. Once through the rapids, I resumed paddling, pushing on for a few more hours before making camp on a high bank. That night I had to say a solemn goodbye to an old friend, my pole. It had been with me since early on, back on the Mackenzie River. Shaped by a beaver from balsam poplar, it had served me well, never breaking, and helping me get up rapids beyond counting. I was sad to part with it, much like the feeling one gets with losing a walking stick you've come to know. But from here on out, all my travel would be downstream, across lakes or on foot, and in those scenarios, the pole could be of no further use. And where I was headed, every extra ounce mattered. So, I turned it over one last time in my hands, said goodbye, and set it gently down among some willows. I crawled out of my tent the next morning to find the wind gusting fiercely across the land. The little knee-high willows shook with each burst, and ripples appeared along the river's surface where the powerful gust raced across, like a kind of ghost imprint, as I could see the outline of the air current as it moved rapidly over the water. It wasn't exactly good weather for paddling, but I had the current in my favor and I had to press on. So I pulled on my hat. The wind knocked it off into the willows. I fetched it back and decided I'd go hatless for the day. With the canoe loaded, I set off paddling downriver. It should have been easy, but it was anything but. The howling gusts made steering the canoe difficult. They knocked and jostled it about, at times even overwhelming both the current and my paddle strokes to drive the canoe into the banks. Trying to steer through small rapids and avoid rocks with such tremendous gusts proved frustratingly difficult. The canoe felt as though it were under someone else's control, careening wildly across the river wherever the crazy gusts took it. It was all I could do, battling with all my strength against both current and wind to avoid smashing it into the rocks and the rapids. I tried to escape the brunt of the gusts by tucking in under the high banks whenever I could. It wasn't much help, but it did at least allow me to continue working my way downriver. After about 13 kilometers of difficult paddling, I spotted something up ahead that made my heart beat faster. Thin curls of mist rose, and over the roar of the wind, I could hear a distinct crashing sound of water falling. The far side of the river looked better for approaching this hazard, so I waited for a break in the gusts and then paddled with all my strength for the far shore. When I reached it, I had a clearer view of what lay downriver. It looked like a vertical drop. I'd have to approach it very carefully. If the wind or the current caught me, I might reach a point of no return and plunge right over it, which isn't half as fun as it sounds. The gusts were too steady and too fierce for me to proceed by water, so instead I took the canoe by the bow rope and splashed ahead on foot, towing it behind me until the stream carried it past me. Then I followed behind it. In the far distance ran great blue ridges. Nearer toward me were hills partially covered in dwarf birch. It was a very wind-swept, empty-looking place. As I cautiously edged along the shore, I saw where the river appeared to vanish into thin air, the white water splashing up before it tumbled out of view. I hauled my canoe on shore and secured it so that I could go ahead on foot. I can't recommend enough the need to haul the canoe fully onto the land when doing anything like this. If I'd merely pulled the bow only partway up on some rocks and left it there, disaster could follow if the gusting wind dislodged it and swept it over the falls. I hiked ahead along the curving course of the river, climbing up a steep, high ridge that overlooked it. The winds were fierce as I ascended, and I made sure to keep away from the edge. Once I reached the top, I had a good view of the river's turbulent, roaring course over the rocks. There were two big, foaming cataracts separated by a rocky island, with large rapids above each one. Clearly, I wasn't going to be able to navigate that. A portage was necessary, which, from what I could see, was going to be a long, drawn-out effort. I'd have to haul each of my loads in the canoe a long way to get around the rapids. And then to get back to the water's edge would require a steep climb. In the middle of all this surveying from high above on the ridge, I did pause and think to myself that the vast panorama of open tundra and crashing water looked remarkably beautiful from afar. Scrutinizing the landscape, I began to wonder how I could shorten the lengthy, difficult portage. It appeared that if I could manage to cross the river above the falls to the far side, its mostly flat rocks would mean a much shorter and easier portage than having to climb the steep ridge on this side. But given the rapids and especially the powerful wind gusts, to cross the river would be tricky. I'd have to haul my canoe back up river some ways to be safe, then cut across with hard paddling against the combined force of the wind and current to the far shore. Still, this extra effort seemed worth it, as the portage promised to be much easier on the opposite side. So, I returned to my canoe, splashed back down into the river, and towed it to what seemed like a safe distance up from the thundering cataracts. The wind was still howling, making it hard to hear much of anything between wind and falls. I took a deep breath, pushed my canoe away from shore, leapt in, and began paddling across. Wind gusts almost immediately drove me diagonally in the direction of the waterfalls, which didn't seem desirable. But the canoe actually turned slightly into the current, as if to run the falls, but this I merely did to aid steering, so that the current would help me get across against the wind. I aimed the bow as close as I dared toward where the cascading water began. Several strong strokes brought me to the rocky shore, safely above the start of the turbulent water. I hopped out, grabbing hold of the gunwales as I did so to keep the wind from tearing the canoe away. A short hike convinced me that the portage was indeed relatively easy. Past the flat rock was just a steep, somewhat tricky climb over boulders and ledges to get back to the water's edge at the end. The only serious part would be getting the canoe across. I couldn't drag it over the rocks, and carrying it over my head in the gusting wind promised to be difficult. But there was no other way. I waited for a break in the howling gusts, then quickly lifted the canoe and tossed it over my head. Gripping the gunwales as tightly as I could, I started moving over the rocks. The wind was blowing across my path from the southwest, which meant hitting the canoe broadside. When the really powerful gust came, I'd totter, but rather than trying to stand against the gusts, I'd allow them to pivot me. Since I couldn't hope to hold the canoe against them without falling, I'd just spin with the wind so that the canoe was aerodynamic, the stern end facing into the wind. Then, in the relative lull between gusts, I could safely continue. I climbed down the rocks with the canoe over my head, but when I reached the last steep bit, I had to set it down. This final stretch was too steep to climb in the wind with the canoe over my head, so I half carried it, half pushed it down the rocks. Immediately ahead lay more small rapids and boulder fields to canoe through. In calm weather, they'd be fun to plunge through. In the high winds, a bit of a nightmare. Still, I pushed off into the current, paddling as well as I was able and choosing the widest, deepest spots between the protruding rocks and the rushing waters to snake through. The last thing I wanted was for the wind to hurl the canoe into a big rock, capsizing and pinning it there as the current flooded it. When you see destroyed canoes along rapids, certain popular paddling rivers have veritable graveyards of them. That's normally what did them in, becoming pinned on rocks where they get bent round like horseshoes by the tremendous force of the water. The ruined, abandoned canoe I'd seen along the copper mine had been such a case. When I got through these obstacles, the river brought me to a rectangular-shaped lake not quite 11 kilometers long and about 3 or 4 kilometers wide. Along its southern shores was a long escarpment, or ridge. If not for the winds, I would have admired it. As it was, the gusting wind, which was bad enough on a closed-in, narrow river, was almost impossible on a long lake. To cross it, ideally, I needed to be on the south shore, where I'd be more sheltered from the prevailing winds by the hills. The problem was the river flowed into the northern part of the lake, and to get over to the south shore would mean paddling into headwinds for some 3 kilometers, an impossible prospect. So, I had no choice but to try the exposed north shore, where the full force of the wind, sweeping across the open water, would be hitting the canoe almost broadside. With hard, furious paddle strokes, I drove the canoe slowly forward, all the while carefully navigating the waves, the bow riding over them as they rolled into shore. Progress was slow, and I kept thinking that it was only August 11th, and that the really powerful winds hadn't even arrived yet. Worse, this was just a small lake. Ahead lay two vastly larger ones that I'd have to cross, and still others beyond that. As I continued deeper into the lake, waves began to spill into the canoe, lapping against its side with a thud and splashing up into the air, some of the water landing on my gear and soaking it. My heart sank. To push on in these waves was to risk swamping. I'd have to head to shore. Cautiously, I turned the canoe with the waves, paddling into a grassy peninsula to wait things out. On shore, I tried to make myself as comfortable as possible, telling myself this would be a temporary delay, and that getting windbound for an afternoon, even several days, was to be fully expected on the Arctic tundra. But try as I may, I found it difficult to relax with the wind roaring. I couldn't help fretting over what this wind boded for the weeks ahead. Time was critical. I had to do alone, in deteriorating weather, what it had taken those two paddlers longer to accomplish earlier in the season, 20 years earlier. Right now, it was difficult to see how that was possible, given I was sitting on shore rather than canoeing, staring at frightful waves. There was some slight consolation nearby when I noticed earth and rocks had been dug up in 5 or 6 places. These, I knew, were from a grizzly digging up the burrows of Arctic ground squirrels. Those adorable little squirrels are the favorite hors d'oeuvres of the Arctic grizzly. 2.5 centuries ago,